No, I tried to switch out.
I tried to do better.
No, that's good.
You're listening to Please Be Reasonable, where we seek to speak humbly and passionately about things that matter and things that don't.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Please Be Reasonable. I'm your co-host, Sam.
And I'm your co-host, Josh.
Josh, my dude. What's up with you, man?
I'm eating this bagel you gave me.
Sounds like your life's pretty good.
It is pretty good. Can't complain.
So we're hanging out at my house. It's late. We're getting a podcast groove going. It's been a hot minute. We've been busy. We've been unfaithful to our schedule. Do you hear that? Is that an airplane?
Is that a
what?
2000s era CCM dance pop music?
What is that? It sounds like 2000s Christian dance pop.
What's going on?
This is the dumbest intro ever. If any of you recognize this song, then you already know what we're talking about today. I wish you could see this music video. This is Brian Duncan's famous single, Left Behind. You might think I'm
crazy, but I've been feeling. That was really smooth.
Yeah, wasn't that? That was perfect timing. So Josh, what are we talking about tonight?
We are talking about the end of all things.
Yes, the apocalypse, the end times, the judgment day. Today we are talking about what's
that? Eschatology.
Eschatology. It's really sad that I'm a pastor and I don't know that word. I feel like that probably lets you in on my bias concerning eschatology.
You can blame the music. It's so distracting.
It's so good.
What kind of eschatology did you grow up with, Sam?
Or do you want to jump right into it? You're just going straight in?
Oh, I forgot. You were doing the intro preview and then you were going
to... I mean, it was just... I just thought that was a fun way to start the show.
I know, but... it was.
So we are talking about eschatology tonight, but before we jump in, Josh, it's been a while. How are we doing? Is there anything you need to catch up on? Anything you want to share with me? Is there anything you need to confess right now?
Confess?
Yeah. Any deep, dark secrets you need to drop out of the depths?
Right, in public, in this podcast. I not read my Bible today.
Wow. That's it? That's all you got? Nothing juicier?
That I'm going to share in public?
Did you vote for Donald Trump?
No. I did vote for a certain governor that I'm a little disappointed
in. Oh, yeah. We should have talked about Greg.
No, because there's stuff comes out and then other stuff comes out, and it's just best to lay low and wait.
Just not talk about anything.
Wait anything for Greitens related.
Here's the deal. By the time this podcast come out, he will have great-grandchildren. So at our current release schedule, anything we say about it will be totally out of date by the time anyone hears it. But anyway.
This ain't no political podcast.
Exactly. Dude, so I think this is kind of cool in light of what we're talking about. I recently reread a book that I read back in college. A little bitty book called The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen. Have you ever read it?
No, but I've heard of Henry Nouwen.
Yeah.
He's big in people that are into intentional communities.
Yes.
They like him.
Yeah, he's kind of a mystical Christian guy from the 70s. He kind of, I mean, very different and nuanced, but imagine kind of same kind of vibe as like a Brendan Manning or someone like that. Anyway. It's this little book, The Wounded Healer, and it's a ministry book from, I think it was written in the late 70s or early 80s. It's pretty old, but it's interesting in that it's predictive of postmodern culture and some of the movements that happened in the church in postmodern culture. And so he kind of picks apart what he thinks ministry is going to look like in the coming decades. And he, again, written late 70s, early 80s. So he's really talking about what's ministry going to look like going into the 90s and 2000s?
So he predicted youth groups with dodgeball?
No, but he has this term he calls the nuclear man, which is basically his term for people who've grown up in a reality where there are nations with nuclear arms and cold wars and an actual present reality of human destruction. And talks about how that affects the human psyche and the human understanding of spirituality and how that needs to affect our understanding of ministry. And he builds this idea that the thing that's the most interesting thing in the book, and I think it actually has effect for our discussion today about eschatology, because he gets a lot into kind of this almost spiritual nihilism that comes out of this thought of your potential destruction, right? But he coins this phrase. He talks about how the next generation, so again, this is like Xers and millennials, he says, will be defined by psychological and spiritual fatherlessness. And what he means by that is not physical lack of fathers. It's that when you see the world as inherently chaotic and potentially destructive, then any authority figure loses its actual protective covering. So it may continue to be an authority figure, but it ceases to be fatherly because it can't actually protect you. And I thought that is interesting. That has a ton of implications for how I do ministry and how people engage the gospel truth. But anyway, it's a great book. You should pick it up. It's like 95 pages. You can read it in like two sittings.
Yeah, it's interesting because my first reaction to hearing you describe that is that that view makes sense coming from post-World War II new nuclear thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet is almost a little distant fated for us now.
Talk to me about it.
Like, well, just the whole, like then our parents' generation grew up with, you know, the Cold War and drills mm-hmm. in school and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we kind of know in an abstract sense that nuclear weapons are a thing, but, like, we don't really view it as a day-to-day reality. It's a little more faded for us.
Yeah, but I think that that specific thing he grabs onto, I think you're right. That's a generational difference there. But I think the general principle that the world is kind of like destructive and evil and chaotic and post 9/11 world in a global world and an internet connected world with 24-hour news cycle, I think has essentially the same psychological effect, right? When you're talking about the potentials of terror attacks and mass shootings and things like that, it kind of puts this sense of chaos and fragility into safety in life, which is really essentially what he's talking about. But he uses the reality of nuclear arms and the Cold War to get there. But yeah. Anyway, the world's going to end, Josh. That's what I'm getting at.
Like soon, right?
Yeah, it's all going away, all going to burn, all going to explode. Fire. Kirk Cameron will be there. And.
Because he gets left behind.
And that's all I know about it.
Well,
Jesus.
This is pretty much...
Mark Driscoll says Jesus will be there and he'll have a big tattoo. And he'll kill a bunch of people. Because that's how you know he's manly. I'm sorry, that's a different podcast.
But no, like, we pretty much grew up, as I'm sure many of our listeners did, with an evangelical culture that was very focused on the end times.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Left Behind books mm-hmm. came out while we were like in high school
mm-hmm.
and they were like really popular,
mm-hmm.
like bestseller.
Did you read them?
Yeah.
All of them?
Almost. Like when it actually gets to the Millennial Kingdom or whatever and it gets kind of boring, which is funny because I want to talk about that later when we talk about stuff, but like... Yeah, no, I read them, and it was all, because it was kind of this culture war thing, like, oh yeah, these Christian books are popular in the culture, it's like mm-hmm. spreading the gospel, and, you know, just everywhere, churches and Christian schools and books and the music, even, it was all,
just, that song, I'm sorry, Brian Duncan, is that his name?
Yeah.
Sorry, Brian Duncan, for mocking your career and your contributions to the kingdom.
But like everywhere, it was just this idea that
yeah.
things are getting worse and worse, as just as was predicted in the Bible, and eventually God's going to say, I've had enough, and Jesus comes back, and, you know, two will be walking, and one will be gone, and we'll go up to meet him in the air, And then all the tribulation stuff happens, and, you know, and everything, you know, obviously things are just getting worse and worse. And it was reinforced, all the news headlines, and, you know, we had world wars, and there's crime, and there's, you know, just whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, it's interesting looking back that, like, I was almost unaware that there was any other Christian views.
Really?
Like, almost. Like, so, like, one thing that I appreciate about my father is that I was exposed to, like, differences in views in some things. It's like he would be interested in certain things, and, like, he was really interested in end times and views and Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we would watch these videos from different people on their stuff.
Oh, my God.
And, like, it was all what we would call dispensationalism.
Okay.
Like, it was all rapture,
yeah,
you know, tribulation, all this stuff. But, like, I was exposed to, like, differences of, like, well, some people think this means this, and some people think that means that. So, like, I was a little bit exposed to, like, oh, there's difference of opinion within this, what I now know is a little more of a narrow view.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Sorry.
But that, like, I was exposed to a little bit. And that was, like, that was what bothered me about the Left Behind books was not that they didn't, like, talk about these other completely different views within Christianity, because I didn't really know about them. But what bothered me was, like, one of the characters in the book would be, like, oh, Revelation, whatever, 8 says this is going to happen next, and that means this is going to happen next, so we can prepare for it, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, what they should have done was say, the character in the book should have said, well, we don't know for sure if it's going to be this or this. And they should have to wait to see.
Oh, my gosh.
But then we had this friend, we had a close friend, John,
okay,
whose church taught something totally different.
Yeah.
And that, like...
What's up, John?
Like, the most of the events of Revelation had already been fulfilled, and the world was getting better and better.
Yeah.
And it was, like, it was so different from everything else in my... influences, and so obviously wrong to me, that, like, I never really understood it.
Oh, John, I hope you are listening right now. That was amazing.
Well, we're gonna redeem that, I think, on this podcast.
Yeah.
But that was kind of what I grew up with.
Do you want to ask me about what I grew up with?
What did you grow up?
Because it's really funny, especially based on what you said. So we've talked about this before, but I grew up in a very traditional Southern Baptist church, and yet, somehow, I was immune to almost all of this stuff. Almost entirely. So, I've never read a single Left Behind book. I think my older brother read, like, half of them. I have a graphic novel of the first part of the first book. And I read it, and my mom saw it and was like, that stuff's garbage. Don't believe it. And that was, like, the totality of the discussion. It's crazy. Like, my parents were never into that. If they were, they never talked to us about it. In my church, there was always this view that, like, Christ's return was soon. And that sort of thing would be said often, either guest preachers or revival preachers. That's a thing Baptist churches do, would be revival weeks, and revival preachers would be like, I just got a feeling. I got a feeling that Jesus is going to return in my lifetime. All you youngins, you're going to see the day. And then they would say that sort of thing. But that, I mean, I'm not joking when I say that is 100% of my exposure as a child to those things. My pastor, when Left Behind was getting really popular, was really quick to just be like, this stuff's popular. You can read it if you want to. But just remember, Jesus says no one knows the day or the hour, so don't worry about it. Just worry about being ready. And that's the thing, is my pastor was much more an evangelist than he was maybe like a theologian. And so his whole thing was like, don't worry about end time stuff. Just make sure your heart's ready for when it happens and get as many people as you can ready for when it happens.
Okay, so they weren't generally saying like, oh, this overall idea of dispensationalism is incorrect. They're just saying don't worry about, don't treat it like a big popular culture thing.
I'm fairly certain, looking back, because I didn't know those terms at that point, I'm fairly certain my pastor growing up was dispensationalist. I just don't think he put any, like, necessary weight,
mm-hmm,
on those things. Now I'm probably not that. And by probably, I mean I'm not that. But well,
we're gonna we're definitely gonna talk about some other views. But I see, because in all the culture that I was in, like, people would always quote the verse, "No one knows the day or the hour," and it was always like, "We're not picking dates, but."
I can't tell you a date, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be in my lifetime.
Obviously getting closer. Like, come on. We're not picking dates because, that one guy back in whatever date he was wrong and that other guy was wrong. We're not picking dates, but we kind of are picking general time span.
This is really interesting since we're talking about this. I have a clear memory of a revival preacher that came and spent two nights talking about his take on certain signs in Matthew and Revelation that have been fulfilled in modern times. And like, he spent the whole sermon talking about those things. And I actually specifically remember my dad taking us to dinner afterwards and being like, just ignore that stuff. He's just guessing.
Yeah.
And like, I remember at the time being astounded because I was like, whoa, he's making those Bible prophecies like fit into modern times. That's crazy. And it just like blew me away because I'd never heard any of that sort of thing before. And my dad was just really dismissive of it. I'm just like, don't worry about that stuff.
Huh. Yeah. I remember I definitely remember being aware of don't pay too much attention to specific things, but we were always also like encouraged to look for them.
That's hilarious.
Like being aware that all the predictions have always been wrong. So don't get too caught up, but still encouraged to look for maybe this will be the real one.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole, did you grow up ever wondering is the rapture going to happen?
I had a nightmare about the rapture.
Cause I've heard of people being pretty traumatized by that.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a nightmare about the rapture once. And it might've been that same revival speaker talked about. I remember at some point it was talked about in my church. And my parents being like, well, it doesn't matter because you're a believer and it might not be real anyway.
Well.
It's hilarious. I remember in college, so we went to Lindenwood University together in St. Charles, and I was in the theology program that existed there for a season. Christian ministry program applied. It was a theology program that existed there for a while. And I remember one of the students one day being like, I'm doing a presentation today on how the rapture's not real. And it was at a lunch table or something. And other theology students were like, oh my gosh. And I remember being like, is that controversial? I thought most people thought that. And I remember in the space just being like, why are these people weirded out by this? I thought that thing was just kind of open to interpretation.
Cause I remember I can think of multiple verses from the Gospels, 1 Thessalonians, all these in Revelation and even stuff connecting to Daniel, there are all these verses to support this theology that's obviously all these verses say this.
Everyone's getting raptured.
How else? And I never ever heard any other explanation for all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it was obviously this is the correct, this is the only consistent, correct view.
Yeah. It's creepy to think about, especially for little kids. It's super creepy. The whole thing of Left Behind, right? You're stuck here. All the good people are gone. And you're here because you're bad. It's just oh man, that's so heavy. On a side note, I think part of the reason why my parents were hesitant with that sort of stuff is both of them were really influenced by the late great Planet Earth in high school. And I think that kind of burned them. And they were I want to be careful about this stuff.
Yeah.
Because they were really into that. And even, had me read it. And then after I read it, we're like, hey, no, that stuff's not true.
So, they were expecting it earlier. And then because of that, now they were kind of turned off to the newer iterations.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I've heard that there was, even in the 1800s, there were a group, the Millerites.
Oh, yeah, Millerites.
Expecting some kind of rapture then. And, but I wonder specifically, you were talking about post-World War II, nuclear stuff, Cold War, like, if that environment, like, kind of primed the baby boomer generation to, like, expect, like, well, man, the whole Earth is, like, on the verge of destruction here. Like, this has got to be, this has got to be getting close, you know?
Yeah. It's funny, too. We talked about this a little bit. This might have been what sparked us doing this episode. We talked about this a little bit in our environment episode.
Yeah, yeah.
About the idea of how your view of eschatology, and specifically this, like, hardcore rapture, Jesus is coming back soon understanding, basically just says, like, screw planet Earth, like, do whatever the heck you want.
Because there's a verse, like, the Earth will be destroyed by fire.
Yeah, it's all going to go be burned up anyway, so might as well drive my Suburban now.
But
Josh, I got rid of my 1997 Suburban.
Yeah?
Yeah. Got rid of it.
Did you replace it with something that gets better gas mileage?
No. I replaced it with a 2001 Suburban.
Well, that's probably, it's probably something incremental on it. But Sam, there are other views that are biblically consistent and reasonable.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Tell me.
Well, we could talk about John's view for a minute.
Well, okay, I'm gonna backtrack from that cheesy question I just asked you, because, like, okay, my dad gave me this book, and sometimes he just gives me books that I find interesting. So I got this book, Four Views on the Book of Revelation, and it was really interesting, first because it was the first time I'd actually heard explained, like, the preterist view, the idea that most of Revelation was fulfilled in the first century, and it was really interesting. I'd never heard it before, and a lot of details really interesting. But second of all, it kind of gave me this general framework to think about this stuff that I kind of realized explains some of my own shift in thinking over the last 10, 15 years.
Okay.
Like, basically the idea of things in the world are getting worse and worse, or things are getting better and better. And, like, you know, how, if the kingdom of God is advancing on the earth, or is it waiting for Christ to come back to be fully established, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because I realized, like, I grew up with the idea that things are getting worse and worse until Christ comes back. And I've pretty much shifted now to believing things are getting better and better, or at least that, like, the kingdom is... I've come to a different and more expansive view of, like, what it means of what the kingdom of God means.
Okay.
And what it means establishing that in the earth. Kind of, you know, like, we're going to a church that's involved in, like we like to say, deeds of righteousness and justice, and lots of service and ministry and generosity, and also, like, just from a, even from a secular perspective, like, 90% of absolute poverty has disappeared in, like, the last 100 years. Like, there's a lot of just really interesting stuff going on in the world.
Yeah.
And so I realized that I've kind of shifted to a view that, like, things are getting better and better, or at least in many ways. But that shift had happened, like, around other areas of my theology and philosophy without ever really, like, changing my understanding of Revelation in the end times. I just kind of had, like, set it on a back burner and I really thought about it.
Yeah.
And so this book kind of gave me a little more framework for, like, the views that interact with that philosophy.
Okay. So can we walk through the four views kind of generally?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's... We don't necessarily have to do, like, a straight 1, 2, 3, 4, but, like, so there's the dispensational view,
woo!
Or which it even calls classic dispensationalism, which is, like, the general view we grew up in.
Yes.
Rapture, things get worse and worse, then the rapture comes, then tribulation, all the different things, Revelation, then Christ comes back, establishes the millennial kingdom, where things are great.
Can I, really quick, can I interject something here?
Yeah.
There's a church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. And I can't remember the name, but it might be Gateway Bible Church. I don't remember. It might be just Fairview Heights Bible Church. Point is, they have on their campus a small log cabin that they built. It's not like a historical building. They just wanted a log cabin. So they built it. And it's like a lecture hall, but a log cabin lecture hall. And inside it, there is a probably 20-foot by 40-foot mural depicting all the dispensations from Genesis to Revelation.
See, I don't even remember what the word dispensation actually means in this context.
It just means essentially different periods of time, different ages.
Okay.
And God functions a specific way in each age.
Because people that believe in all that theology that we grew up in don't ever call it dispensationalism. It's only the people that are like, no, dispensationalism is wrong, that call it dispensationalism.
Oh, what do those people call it? Just biblical theology? This is just what the Bible teaches.
Basically. Bible-believing evangelicals.
Really? I've never heard
someone theology? I don't know.
Disavow the dispensational label. Interesting.
Well, no, not disavow, but just like, I never heard that term.
Oh, okay.
Until it was used by people like differentiating between other views.
Gotcha.
Like,
okay.
The fact that there were other views that called other things, like, you know, it was kind of this, like I said, it was this bubble with different views within the bubble.
Yeah.
But never labeled as an overall category called dispensationalism, of which there were also other categories.
Okay.
And so that's the one of the views in the book, which I'm assuming a lot of our listeners are more familiar with. A second view is called preterism.
Yes. John, shout out to you.
And which I now find a lot more reasonable than I did when I was 15. And so it basically, the overall thrust is that most of the events in Revelation were fulfilled in the first century. Which coming from a dispensationalist view is like, what, that's crazy, like, there's locusts and there's a third of the earth being destroyed, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff happening.
Yeah.
But the basic, it mostly orients around the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened in AD 70,
mm-hmm.
About 40 years after Jesus crucified, and basically goes like that being a cataclysmic event for the Jews and yep. even the early Christians. And so what this book explained kind of some stuff about, there's all this symbolic language in Revelation.
Yeah.
There's actually like over like 200 of love, 400 odd verses in Revelation have references back to the Old Testament. And so there's all this like imagery and language that borrows from the Old Testament specifically around like, judgment coming to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And so it connects that language to like the destruction of Jerusalem being God's judgment on Israel for crucifying Jesus. And then like Jerusalem representing the harlot of Babylon in contrast with the bride of Christ. There's like this transition revelation between the harlot and the bride.
Yeah.
And that's all representative of, okay, so first there's all the destructive stuff has to do, is connected to like the attack on Jerusalem, and they make all these connections with the writings of Josephus and how this represents this event and this represents this event. And then the ultimate destruction is seen as there's even this, he points this passage in Hebrews about like the old way of sacrifice is passing away and will be ending soon, kind mm-hmm. of a thing. Like there's a sort of transitional period still.
Yeah.
And then they see like the destruction of Jerusalem as being like the final ending of all that. And then that's like Revelation 17 or so. And then Revelation 18 or so, it goes, is it the bride of Christ? And they're saying, well, the church is the bride of Christ. And so they're saying the binding of Satan described in Revelation that dispensationalism says that's one of those things that happens after the tribulation, that happened in the first century with Jesus' resurrection.
Ooh, and interesting. You know,
it connects to some other verses in Paul's epistles about how Satan has been disarmed and different things. So the binding of Satan happened in the first century.
Also,
the beginning of the millennial yeah. kingdom was in the first century. And that's the general period that we're in now as the kingdom is slowly but increasingly established. And one of the other big reasons where they argue for all this is that Jesus famously said this generation shall not pass away till all these things take place. And then Revelation, both in the beginning verses and in the ending verses, refer to the time is near, these things will happen soon. And so they say, all that only makes sense. It was talking about something that was coming, you know, within their lifetimes. And then they still believe that Jesus will return and usher in, like, the finality of the, I guess, the end time or whatever, the final era.
Yeah.
But that it's not... all the rapture tribulation stuff isn't part of that. But there's just this final era coming when, you know, all the suffering and death will finally be eradicated. But we are working towards that point now.
Yeah. That view, I've heard that view before called preterist, obviously. But I've also heard it. I mean, that tends to be the view that falls in the people who are more covenantal in their understanding of scripture. Covenantalism versus dispensationalism. That tends to be that view. I've heard it called the 80-70 doctrine or covenantal eschatology. Yeah.
So there are some other terms you can Google if you want to learn more.
Yeah.
did that description, me summarizing what I got from that book, did that kind of jive with what you've been taught or go with?
Yeah.
And yeah, so I find all that really interesting and it kind of makes sense to me. I don't know exactly what they do with the quote unquote rapture verses, different things like two will be walking, one will disappear, one will be left.
Yeah.
And the one about we shall all be caught up to meet him in the air.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Although maybe, I mean, that's not necessarily tied to a specific point in Revelation.
Yeah, that could be.
Like, dispensationalism just kind of makes the case that, oh, these other verses, like, I don't think there's actually even a rapture really in Revelation. It just kind of gets put into a point in the timeline.
Yeah, I think it's interpreted into it.
Yeah.
Not explicit.
So. But yeah, it's, I think I had a train of thought. Where was I going? Did you have something to say?
I want to say it. I want to get through all of them before I say something.
Okay. Well, I think those are kind of the main two. There was this, it had four views in the book. There was this third one called progressive dispensationalism, which is kind of like a combination of both those two views.
Really?
Which is like, well, some of the stuff in Revelation applies to the first century, but some of it has yet to be fulfilled. They talk about the already but not yet hermeneutic approach. They're like, some things have been fulfilled, but haven't necessarily been exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still final fulfillment coming.
Yeah.
So they're almost like a combination of both views. And the fourth view was the idealist view, which is kind of like, these are all wrong. There's not like, it's not that these events are specific to the first century or to the last century or to both centuries. They're all, it's all just this metaphorical thing about the ongoing struggle between God and the forces of evil. And...
yeah.
Basically.
I've heard that view articulated a lot recently, centering around some of the discussions with Rob Bell's book on scripture and Rachel Held Evans' book on scripture. Heard people.
I feel like it would definitely.
Yeah.
That camp would kind of gravitate more towards that kind of view.
Yeah.
And it had. That view kind of has. Like. That view offers things for today. Like for the current reader of like, oh, this is how you can be encouraged in your struggles or how you're being called to participate in fighting the evils of the day.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Revelation is all about God conquering evil empires and God still conquers evil empires today. And so you can be a part of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even believe that and also one of the other views really.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Which would probably be closer to like a Shane Claiborne kind of guy, because I hear him use that kind of language a lot.
Yeah. It's interesting. Well, did you want to say something else?
I mean, my whole thing with this in general is just I'm so apathetic about this. And I'm really, I know we're going to talk a little bit about the implications of your view. and how that works out practically in your theology. And that's actually the part of this I'm most interested in, because I hear these views and I'm just like, okay. And I know for a fact this goes back to just my upbringing and my faith tradition and what we already talked about. But I just like, none of those are in particularly more compelling to me than the rest. But the main reason is just because I don't have eschatology on the mind in general. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I know most people in kind of my camp, in this kind of like reform church planning world, would probably fall somewhere on the preterist or the mixed view. But I just like, it just comes up so rarely. You know what I mean? Like the amount that that sort of thing was talked about when we were kids versus the amount of, that it comes up in pastoring and church planning now is, it's astounding to me. Like I've been pastoring a long time and I've never felt compelled to preach on that sort of thing just because it doesn't come up in our church context.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting to learn about kind of the broader range of views after seeing the specific emphasis.
Yeah. Yeah.
In American evangelical culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
And wondering how much of it was tied to current events. And
I think those views we just communicated, I think those pretty much are probably just representative of evangelical or Protestant culture. Like, and this is the problem too, is like, I'm not a good eschatologist. Like I don't have a good, like deep rooted foundation in eschatology, like end times theology. But I'm pretty confident that our Coptic and Catholic and Orthodox brothers probably have some different views on this than even we're representing right here.
Yeah, could be. I guess we don't really have anything to say about that.
Sorry, Orthodox friends.
I'm really interested, and maybe this kind of will transition us into practical implications, but
yeah.
I'm really intrigued by the whole idea of the millennial kingdom.
Yeah.
Because, like,
millennials are the worst. So entitled.
It has. It'll
be the most entitled kingdom of all time. Am I right?
Millennial kingdom. Wow.
Oh, that was bad. Can I add a fifth view really quick while we're on the topic of bad jokes?
Yeah. No, that's actually, like, pretty profound, though.
The millennial kingdom?
Yeah.
Or my fifth view?
No, the millennial kingdom.
Oh.
Because I was going to tell you your fifth view and then we'll come back to why I think it's profound.
This is so bad that I don't even want to say it. One of my theology professors, Dr. Steve House, I think he said this once a semester at some point when he would be joking about eschatology. And he would go, well, there's post-millennialists and pre-millennialists and amillennialists, but I'm a pan-millennialist.
It all just pans out?
It all just pan out in the end.
I think I heard that joke from my dad sometime.
So anyway, the millennial kingdom, super entitled, very Instagrammable. Well,
no, but I feel like the view that the baby boomer culture handed to us didn't really emphasize the millennial kingdom.
Yeah.
And maybe millennials are more interested in it. It's there on the timeline, like rapture, tribulation, millennial kingdom, and like it's this specific litter of 1,000 years, and then there's the new heaven or but the whole overarching like view of, oh, things get worse and worse, then Christ comes back, and then it's all great, we're in heaven. Like, the millennial kingdom didn't really get much emphasis in there.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting now as I, like, you know, dig into the prophets and digging into the you know, different cross-references between things and, like, the overall theologies. Like, there's, like, a lot of talk about, like, this coming era of like, not like a new heaven, like, that's like what we think of as like this eternal state where it, you know, completely removed from the earth, but
almost like a new Israel.
Yeah. Like, you know, like, all these references to like life on earth, but like a perfect life on earth.
Yeah.
Like there's this one, and they quote it somewhere in this book, one of the more canonical is Isaiah 65. I don't know if I'm going to find it quick enough here. But it basically is like, behold, I will create a new heavens and a new earth. Never again will there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. He who dies at 100 will be thought a mere youth. He who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. It's talking about like a new heaven and new earth, but it's talking about people still dying but living to be really old. Still living and dying like on the earth, but having a peaceful, prosperous, like beautiful life.
That's interesting.
And like, I feel like I grew up mostly just with this idea of a heaven, but not really much about like what this new earth actually meant.
Yeah.
And like, you know, they talk about too, you know, the in Revelation about the tree that's for the healing of the nations.
Yeah.
And like, you know, what does that mean in like a view where it's just like everybody's in heaven? Like, there's nations that need healing. Like, what's that all about? Like,
well, I don't know. I've kind of always just read that as like every worldview and tribe and culturally represented, and that the tree of life will, you know, reconcile them.
Yeah, but all through the prophets, there's all this language going on like that.
Yeah.
About
literally, as you're talking about this, I'm going, I've literally never given an ounce of thought of that.
Yeah, and so that's interesting to me now.
Yeah.
With like the theology that I believe about like what Christians are called to do in the world today.
Yeah.
Serving the poor and like, you know, promoting that kingdom in whatever way we are meant to do. Or what that we can do, but it's just interesting, like, you know, because it, like, it's almost like, especially because, okay, yeah. So for the view that the millennial kingdom is already here, that Jesus started it in the first century, like, you could say, well, we're obviously not there because people don't like. There's all kinds of suffering in the world.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you could argue like we're getting closer. Like, life expectancy is up into the 80s now.
Yeah.
Like, in another 50, 100 years, barring nuclear war or catastrophic climate change or asteroid, you know, whatever, maybe it's actually feasible that, like, living to 100 would be considered normal.
Like, yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting thing to think about. Although, I guess if you're not going to take the 1,000 years literally, maybe you don't take the 100 years literally either. But... although that side note is a point for some of the critics of the dispensational view, like on the one hand, the dispensationalists say we're taking everything literally. Like, this isn't some metaphoric apocalyptic thing. Like, these seven bowls, seven judgments. These are real things that will happen. You know, even the Left Behind books, they're real locusts that come out. But then, like, they still take certain things in there figuratively. Like,
yeah,
the story with the
do.
Dragon. Like, well, that's not a woman giving birth. Like,
there's not a dragon sitting at a hospital. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, everybody takes things metaphorically one way or another.
That's the part, on a side note, that does not sit well with me with the traditional dispensational view. Because it's essentially saying, look, we know this is a historic genre that existed and tons of other people wrote in that, but this one's different. And I don't know. That seems short-sighted to me.
Yeah. Back to the New Earth Kingdom thing. I don't know. I'm really intrigued by studying that sort of thing now.
Yeah, now I'm intrigued.
And it's interesting. So, like, I've heard N.T. Wright talks kind of in his book Simply Christian about the... traditional view in evangelical culture of heaven and earth as different places or different spheres of existence, and we die, we go from earth to heaven. But he kind of talks about like them as more of like these overlapping spheres or dimensions or something,
mm-hmm.
and like like the resurrection is a point of intersection.
Yeah.
And like anywhere that now the kingdom becomes further established, is like little previews of intersection and overlapping that's expanding until one day when they become fully together, like they're always meant to be.
Yeah.
And the Bible Project has a good short little video on describing that view too.
Side note, if you're at all curious about some of the big questions of genre and literature in the Bible, you should all go on the Bible Project's website because it's great.
Yeah.
Great, great, great.
Yeah. And a lot of the stuff they get into on different topics, sometimes it's like a little bit broader than like what was common in a lot of our evangelical subculture,
mm-hmm.
but it's still very like, biblical,
yeah,
conservative, mm-hmm. even maybe.
Oh, it's definitely conservative leaning, like definitely, but it's really good. I mean, it's essentially a lot of the stuff they're making is a biblical theology textbook made into little 8-minute videos.
That's accessible.
Yeah,
to people.
Really accessible.
And I find a lot of it just like invigorating and refreshing and
yeah.
exciting, kind of new, almost new perspectives on things, but that makes sense. That's
yeah.
really cool. So N.T. Wright's book, Simply Christian, and the Bible Project view on, I forget if it's what the video is called, if it's heaven or heaven and earth or something, that's basically what the whole thing is about, the idea of overlapping spheres and all that. I like that, but I also like don't know how that fully meshes with, just some of the other verses in the Bible that are used to support the dispensational view or of heaven and earth at separate places.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's really interesting though.
I just nodded to let you know that I think it's interesting. And then I realized this is a podcast and I shouldn't nod.
Well, and also, one last thing on this topic specifically about the kingdom is like, I've always thought it was interesting that how to look at how the Jews in the first century like misinterpreted Jesus.
Yeah.
Like, because they were expecting this coming kingdom that all the prophets are talking about.
Yeah.
With the Messiah figure and all the stuff. And they thought
violence and war and.
Yeah, he was going to end all that obvious oppression and injustice for the Romans.
Yeah.
And so they were like a little surprised when.
They're just a little bit surprised.
When
he didn't do any of that.
Oh, the kingdom's a little bit different than what we thought.
Yeah.
But there's still like this hope of this final victory. But it was
yeah.
kind of like split into like two comings.
Yeah.
Kind of. And then, but then like all this talk today, especially in dispensationalism of like, oh, when he's coming back the second time, like I feel like that's probably subject to the same potential misunderstanding, like of like how exactly like it may be different from our expectations.
Yeah.
Like, still like in hindsight, like, oh, makes sense.
Yeah.
But like, because even like there's almost, even in that view, there's almost like two second comings.
Yeah.
Like once for the rapture and then once again with the sword and the,
yep.
the Driscoll tattoo.
Yep.
Thigh tat covered in blood.
I don't know.
He's so manly.
I feel like you said about just being all like apathetic.
Yeah.
Like, there's probably a better word to convey what we mean, but like,
yeah, because it's obvious. I'm not trying to be dismissive of scripture.
Almost like a casual, like a humility of like, not going to hold on too strongly to something because pretty much the entire history of Christianity has misunderstood.
Yeah, I mean, the reason the Pharisees missed Jesus, I mean, there's a bunch of them, but one of the biggest ones is that they had a very concrete understanding of the prophets. They thought, we have read the prophets, we've studied them, we've figured it out, so we'll know when the Messiah gets here. And that concrete pride is a big part of why they missed him. And to have that go the other direction, I mean, the exact same thing is applicable. And anytime you're trying to nail down the details of the end times using Daniel and Revelation, I mean, you're using this insane imagery and language and like, I mean, even from a very traditional, like literal interpretation view of Revelation, if you think about a guy from the first century prophetically seeing forward to the future, you know, post 2018, then how is he going to explain when he sees airplanes and missiles and machine guns? Like, what sort of words is he going to put to that, because those things don't exist? And so, like, you're talking about stuff where the language fails the truth that's trying to be conveyed. And so you have to do deep level interpretation to pull anything out of it. And so I've always just looked at that and been like, I'm not smart enough to do that. I'm not smart enough to make a definitive statement about how the end times will go down based on what Revelation and Daniel says. And so, I don't know, that might be really foolish. Like, it might be really, really foolish. But I've kind of always held this view of just like, well, I want to do my best to be ready when it gets here, and whatever it looks like, I'll be good.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the question is, does it matter? Like, what you think about what's going to happen.
I know, and you're about to tell me it does, and I need to change the way I do ministry, and
well, if your view of what's going to happen affects what you do now, then it matters.
Okay.
But if it doesn't, if, like, either way you're going to do the same thing, then it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
That's what I'm going to argue here.
All right, Josh, convict, like, me.
Because there's, like, especially the views of, like, things are getting worse and worse, we're just waiting for the end. Like, we've already referred a little bit to, like, how that affects your views on the environment.
Yeah.
And things.
Burn it all!
Just this kind of, like, hunker down mentality.
Yeah.
And, like, I feel like that is not good, not cool.
Yeah.
Versus, like, you know, if, versus the idea of, hey, we're called to do things in the world, so let's just focus on doing them.
Yeah.
And, like, even within, like, a dispensational view, like, you have people arguing for that, too. I think of, there's an old Newsboys song,
yes.
Lights Out.
Yes.
It was like 1992 or something. So that, and I was listening to this when I was like 12. Like, came to it late. But like back when I was fully steeped in,
yeah,
you know, the rapture is obviously gonna happen, and everything. But the whole thing is like, oh, you think you figured out the time? You're gonna turn the lights out and wait on your roof. Don't go shutting down.
Yeah.
Until the trumpet sounds. Like,
oh wow. Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
I don't think I ever realized. I don't think I ever listened to that song closely enough to know what it was about.
What did you think it was about?
I didn't remember that song. I was like, I must not know this one. And then you started telling the lyrics, and I was like, oh no, I remember that one.
Who do you think you are? Did you figure out the time? What do you hope to do by your heart out in mind?
Oh, man. Please keep singing, Josh. More lyrics.
Don't go shutting down till the trumpet sound. Anyway. Yeah, so, you know, they're saying, like, hey, even if the rapture's coming, like, do what you're called to do.
Yeah.
And even,
Man, I'm gonna listen to that song tonight.
Yeah. And with the, with some of these other views, they're like, oh, the kingdom is now being established. Like, it's like a call to participate in that. Like, hey, this is cool. Like, let's spread the love of Jesus and pursue justice and righteousness and care for the widows and the orphans and bring the good news to the poor and all this stuff. And that's where, if, like, even if you feel like it's some of both, or like you don't know, like, you know, we could eliminate poverty in 20 years, or we could have nuclear war. Like, either way, like, does that change what you're called to do?
Exactly. The time that we have? And that's my problem, is I feel like it doesn't matter your view on end times. There's no biblical way to justify a bunker mindset.
Yeah.
Like, you have to disregard everything Jesus teaches about mission and everything Paul teaches about mission.
And possessions.
Yeah, in order to justify
caring
that,
about personal safety.
It doesn't matter how dispensational classic you are, like, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, it's all going to burn. Like, you're still called to be a part of the kingdom and a part of the mission and calling more people to salvation.
Yeah. But I will. One extra thing I want to add, in a little bit of defense of dispensationalism, because we've kind of mostly been ragging on it.
Oh, I'm sorry, dispensationalism.
I think it's just kind of a thing of like we grew up with one thing and now we're exploring other things, and it's just kind of like a reaction to that.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I wouldn't say I'm supporting another view on a side note.
Well, I'm not even saying that I'm officially supporting a view either, but it's kind of like, oh, I always only heard the good things about this, so now I feel like I have to compensate by,
yeah,
well, here's some bad things about this, here's some good things about the other things, even if on its own it's not perfectly balanced.
Yeah.
But I think one of the values of those kind of view is just the urgency that's inherent in it.
Yes,
there can be a positiveness to that.
I think so.
Like, you know, every generation can live as if it could, might be the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's almost like the live every day like it's your last.
Live every day like Jesus is coming back tomorrow.
Which, you know, live every day like you might die tomorrow. Like, it doesn't totally work literally. Like, there's obviously wisdom in long-term planning and different things. But, like, there's an element of, like, you know, don't just get complacent and sit around and, like, there's things you can do.
Yeah.
And should do and seek to do.
Yeah.
And, like, even if every generation thinks their last one before God comes back and they're wrong, if it drives them to do positive things that they're called to do out of that urgency.
Come on, man.
Because there could be a limited time as opposed to just wanting to write it out. Like, then that can be a positive thing.
That's
There's
what I'm
a quote
about.
In that I wanted to kind of sum that up with. It was actually quoting from Tony Campolo.
Oh, yeah. Did you see the interview with Bart Campolo that Science Mike did?
Yeah.
Did you listen to it?
So fascinating.
It's really long.
I could talk about that for like an hour.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
Like, probably with Andy.
Yeah, that'd
or
be good.
Or any of my, like, humanist friends. So fascinating.
I love, on a side note, that you include me in a group chat with Andy where I literally have nothing intelligent to say. I just get to read you guys going back and forth and be like, yes,
Well, I thought you might be more interested in that than he would, because you're more familiar with Tony and Bart Campolo.
Yeah.
And I know you've listened to Science Mike.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought it was appropriate for both of you. Yeah. Anyway, this is from that Four Views in the Book of Revelation book, which I'm not necessarily recommending this book. It's kind of dry, but I found it interesting. Anyway, quotes Tony Campolo and says, "Any theology that does not live with a sense of the immediate return of Christ is a theology that takes the edge off the urgency of faith. But any theology that does not cause us to live as though the world will be here for thousands of years is a theology that leads us into social irresponsibility."
Dang. Tony Campolo with the knife.
So as in so many other things, it's about a balance and trying to hold different things in tension.
Here's my problem, going back to my whole, when I say like I'm not supporting a view, I mean it's 100%. I'm not comfortable with how dismissive traditional dispensationalism seems to be to the genre of apocalypse, but I am equally uncomfortable with how dismissive preterism seems to be to the reality of like prophecy and like supernatural predictive. You know what I mean? And so I look at both of those and I'm just like, I don't know. I don't know how it's going to go down, but I think both of those groups of people are going to be surprised by it.
Yeah.
Dude, I don't know, man. Like, I come back to, because you haven't, I mean, I don't know. I come back to this idea that I feel like it doesn't matter what your view is. You got to be about kingdom work, and kingdom work is about the urgency of sharing the gospel as much as you can. And it's about the stewardship of caring for the creation God put you in charge of. And like, I personally don't see how eschatology would affect either of those things, or should affect either of those things. Like, they're both unavoidable, like, commands of scripture for the believer.
Yeah. I think the, maybe eschatology can serve as like an encouragement.
Yeah.
And like this is the hope. This is our hope of a future where infants don't die
Yes.
And people live to absolutely. Be 100. Like, that's, and that can be like a hope that you're striving towards.
Yeah. I mean,
that sort of a world.
When I think of the idea of the recreation, right, of Jesus actually making all things new, I mean, man, that is the hope of salvation. Like, that is, yeah, like, I definitely long for and look forward to that day in, like a real way, like a way my soul actually engages. I guess just debating on the nitty-gritty of it is just kind of like, I don't see the purpose.
Yeah.
And again, if you're out there listening to this and you're like, wow, Sam, you're so naive. I really might be. I just don't see the benefit in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I just know, like, coming from a view of things are getting worse and worse, and, like, that seem to revolve around a lot of fear and reading things into the news and everything. Yeah. And then coming into kind of more of a N.T. Wright Bible Project, whatever you want to call it, view of work to build the kingdom and strive for that hope. Like, I find that a lot more, I find that just really exciting and fulfilling. And
yeah, dude. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on that?
No.
Well, hopefully we won't get raptured before the next time we do a podcast. Can we do Thing of the Week?
Yep.
Oh, I do that every time. Thing of the week. So this week we are talking about an album. This is two hardcore bands we've talked about. Because we did Sleeping Giant. Yeah. So we're talking about the newest album from Under Oath.
Which people might have actually heard of.
Yeah, Under Oath is definitely more popular than Sleeping Giant. The new album is called Erase Me. If you were in the Christian subculture in the mid-2000s, even if you weren't into them, you probably heard of Under Oath. So
they were Define the Great Line hit number 2 on Billboard.
Yeah.
100,000 copies, which was like the biggest hardcore heavy music ever.
Yeah.
And like,
their only Chasing Safety was their breakout album in like 2005 or 6.
It was like, whoa, this is like the one genre of music where the Christian bands are the most popular.
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the most interesting things in that point in time in the music industry, is it felt like in kind of the emo and hardcore, and even to some extent like the metalcore and metal scene, it felt like the Christian artists were the ones setting the pace, not like catching up. I mean, when you think about bands like Under Oath, bands like Emery, bands like The Chariot and Norma Jean, like, those guys were like setting the pace. Anyway, Under Oath, really well known, kind of as like a Christian emo screaming metalcore kind of band.
Then they kind of fell apart.
Had a huge blow up. And if you follow any of kind of, you know, some of that post evangelical stuff that's out there, even some of like the Bad Christian podcasts and things like that, there's been interviews with the different guys with Under Oath over the last several years. I think they broke up in 2011. Is that right?
Probably somewhere around
there. Yeah. The last several years, just kind of talking about just kind of what went into that and some of the guys wrestling with their faith and really unhealthy relationships. Anyway, whole point of this is they got back together and they made this album, and it's really unique in that it's most of the Under Oath guys, and yet some of them are actively engaged in their faith, and some of them are actively living like atheist or humanistic lifestyles. And they came together as friends to make an album, to make music, to be a band, not necessarily to actually engage any kind of faith message, which was, you know, part of the deal for Under Oath for a long time. They were famous for, they were on Warped Tour forever and ever and ever, and they had like a daily Bible study on Warped Tour for the musicians, and it was a big deal. Obviously not where they're at now. So I'm going to play two clips. This first one is from a song called I Hate It, which I find good. Oh, I meant to start in the chorus. Slow. Oh, here it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's that. Oops, that's that track. I hate it. It's, and again, so like that's Aaron Gillespie singing, and you're hearing in tracks like that, them actually engage some like wrestling with their faith and what does faith look like in a more in a more like post-evangelical and a more I guess secularized mindset. But then some of their other songs are just totally at home secular metalcore songs. I'm gonna play a real quick clip from their first single off it, which was On My Teeth, which is probably the most Under Oath sounding song on the album. Let's see if this will go for me. This is a second intro. I'm gonna put the synth thing going. I'm really into that. Very conveniently stopped it before the F word there, but
yeah, Under Oath is explicit now.
Yeah. So this album does have an explicit label, which is weird for Under Oath, but I think you guys should check it out. Even if you're not necessarily into the genre, it's a really, really interesting case study in kind of the fruit that is being born by the Christian music industry of the 90s and early 2000s. Yeah. Because these guys were the poster childs for success in like that tooth and nail solid state era of Christian rock music. And you know, come 2018, this is the album they're making. So,
well, I remember one of the Bad Christian interviews with Aaron Gillespie saying, like, talking about him leaving the band and everything back then, like, you know, we were like kids in our 20s and got really famous and we had no idea what we were doing and or how to like handle conflicts and pressures and everything.
Yeah.
And then it kind of sounds like maybe they grew up a little bit.
Yeah.
And now we're able to put kind of some things aside and work together again. But they've also kind of evolved in their faith or left.
Yeah.
Like, it almost sounds like they're kind of like a metaphor for, like, our generation that grew up.
Grew up in that world and now they're grown up. Yeah.
And, like, some of us are still Christians but see certain things differently. Some of us have left and trying to work things out together.
And some of us are still Baptist pastors. I can't wait to talk about this. I'm sure we'll do a whole episode on it when it comes out. But Emery's doing this documentary, What Would Jesus Sell? And they're kind of talking about this Christian music industry of that time. But we talked about this before the show. I'm just astounded at the level of pressure and expectation we put on teenagers and people in their 20s. Not just to be artists and not just to be celebrities, but also to be accurate theologians, right? Like the Christian music, like at this time, at least, like when these guys are making music, it wasn't just, are they good musicians? And it wasn't just, are they going to hit it big? Can they handle the fame? It was, can they do those things? And will their lyrics be orthodox? Because if they say the wrong thing, we'll dump them like a sack of bricks.
Well, and not just that, but impeachable character.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait, you mean those traveling rock musicians? One of them had sex out of wedlock?
Not just impeachable character, but actively, like, role modeling for everyone else.
Yeah, it's just, and I'm not saying any of those things are bad things. That's just an insane amount of pressure to put on a 19-year-old. You know what I mean? Like, that's crazy. Because that's like 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Like, that's the age a lot of these guys were when their bands were popping off.
And it's
interesting,
too, like, it was one thing to be a few years younger than them, looking up to them. It's interesting now to be, like, 29 or 30.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they were younger than I am now.
Yeah.
And they have
and they had these huge platforms and all these. I mean, it's crazy. We'll talk about that more at some point, I'm sure. Here comes my big dog. All right, man. You got anything else?
Nope.
Well, on that note, oh, wait. Thank you, Kingly. Thank you for your delicious music. We desperately need this. It's so good. They're working on new stuff.
All right.
I've said that each time, but they really are.
Working.
New stuff, 2018. Kingly, come on, make it happen.
Before
make
Jesus it happen. Comes back.
Yeah. Release your new album. If Jesus comes back before you release it, we won't get to listen to it in heaven. He only will let us listen to things that have been on Joy FM at least once. I'm guaranteed that's in Left Behind somewhere. So check out Kingly, kinglyofficial.com. They're awesome. Thank you for letting us use your music on a crappy podcast. Guys, you're great. On that note, bro, I think I'm going to go read my Left Behind graphic novel because I'm a heretic.
Wait.
I beat you. I had a good one. And I always struggle. I never have one. I had one on deck and you weren't ready.
Yeah, but that's not the heretic view. That's the good Christian.
Oh, dang it. I'm going to go listen to an Under Oath album because I'm a heretic.
I'm gonna go
watch the Rob Bell documentary, The Heretic, because I'm a heretic.
Maybe that's too like obvious.
I'm gonna go.
I don't know.
I'm gonna go hold up a "the end is soon" sign, because the end is nigh sign, because I'm a heretic.
Oh yeah, like the solar eclipse thing from last year.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go reread the Left Behind kids books, because I'm a good millennial.
I forgot to suggest this book, Revelation and the End of All Things by Craig Koster, is a seminary level textbook. It's a Lutheran seminary textbook, and it's really good.